Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with veteran Orlando-based jazz guitarist Chris Cortez. On his latest 2022 CD called Hermanos, he teams up with a good friend and trumpeter Larry Williams, and it's a musical collaboration that goes all the way back to the 80s. He is the owner of the Blue Bamboo Center for the Arts and hasn't released his own music since 2014. Through his work with Larry in the past, they had a huge impact on the scene in Orlando, Florida, and he's releasing some tasty discs now. Enjoy his story.
So I guess that's probably a pretty ample place to start with the idea of this world we're living in, and
wow. You
know, COVID is back out there, but you have new music, and we're obviously on the back end of this pandemic and the chance to perform live, hopefully when it gets warm and things open up in 2022. How does it feel?
I'm excited about the possibility of getting back to something like normal again. It's been a crazy couple of years, and my wife and I have just pivoted again. And all the time, you know, we're just trying to figure out how to just keep doing. We found ways, and I think as a musician, I've grown a lot. I was missing time from my schedule to write and record and play, so I did that.
And I guess that's the point of all of this, too. You know, it's been a time of self-reflection, as you mentioned, pivoting, but there's been a lot of downtime. What did you learn about yourself that maybe you didn't realize before that's going to make you stronger as you promote this new project?
Oh, well, I think that's a great question. You know, I built this a venue. It's called the Blue Bamboo Center for the Arts here in Winter Park, Florida. We're in our fifth year now. It's become a community resource. It's become really important to a lot of people. But it was a huge undertaking. My record label went on hold for a 6-year period of time while we were building it, and then the 5 years getting it on its feet. And now it's a bona fide nonprofit. It's got grant money, it's got donations, and it's a healthy organization. It's not going anywhere. But when the pandemic hit, it was like all of a sudden there was time. And there wasn't anything else to do with it except make music. So I practiced a lot. I really dove into my work, and it carved out a space in my life that I wasn't allowing for. You know, I'm working 15-hour days just trying to run the place. My music had suffered. And when the focus came back to the music, it was like, oh, yeah, this is what I've been supposed to be doing. So then my old friend Larry came back, and he was big inspiration. Also, right at the right time, suddenly there was time to work on the music with him. And so a lot of, you know, big kind of breakthroughs musically happened because I was just able to suddenly make time for it. And then as the business slowly came back, and then we retreated again, but for a while there, we were almost back to normal. And then when that happened, we intentionally left some time in the schedule for the music. So I didn't slip back into my old, you know, obsessive compulsive, I'm the only one who could run this business kind of mindset. So I think a healthier, smaller footprint, if you will, for what we were trying to accomplish to make room for everything. Building it was never meant to be at the cost of my own musical career, but that's kind of what was happening.
Well, and it sounds like that's kind of a part of this process of COVID that I'm hearing over and over from musicians, is that there are all kinds of silver linings. There is, I think, a good benefit for everybody to kind of succumb to the notion that the world's saying you got to stop.
Yes, slow down for a minute and see what it is you're really supposed to be doing. And think about that. Think about the path you're on, and is it the right one for you? Even though you've done some really amazing things, and community's totally behind me here in this project, but at the same time, there's this part of me that I'm just a guitar player. I need to be spending a healthy amount of my time doing that. If I do, it makes the other stuff work out. There's an intelligence to managing a business and not doing every single thing yourself. And part of this was taking on help, was allowing for, okay, if the business, if we're going to grow, we're going to do another night of the week, add another night of the week to the schedule. I need people to help me if we're not going to do that. And before, I never would have said that. I would have said I'm the only one who could do this. So we ran it, you know, 5-6 nights a week, my wife and I, just doing everything for a long time. So I think that's the biggest thing I learned, was just to make time for the stuff that's really important. It was just a terrible time for a lot of us.
I mean, that's the thing. It's been excruciating. On this new project, Romano, what do you ultimately want the listener to get from this experience? What do you hope is conveyed that they feel?
Well, the title is Brother, you know, is Brothers. And this is an old friend of mine, lots of back and forth over the years, living in different parts of the world and focusing on different aspects of our careers apart from one another. And you know how it is, years and years go by and you go, oh, wow, that guy. And social media reunites us, and he sort of was keeping track of us and what we were doing here in Orlando while he was in Ojai, California. And his wife passed away, and he had this dream, and he kind of got into a van and drove across country and came here and said, I had this weird dream that I'm supposed to be playing a trumpet again and here with you. And let's make a record. So it was a combination of him trying to get his trumpet chops back after 10 years and me coming back into the world of music again as a performer. And those two things kind of were very well timed. We've always been songwriters, he and I. So it was a way for us to each share some compositions. There's a couple of old ones on my end and mostly new stuff. And I really just sort of to explore each other again as partners and brothers. And we were very, very close back in the day. So there, all of that history comes along with it. And then a lot of the local musicians that we employed for this were part of our scene back then too. So it's been a real fun walk down memory lane.
So how did this whole bug for not only music but jazz begin, kind of where you were born and raised, and when the flashpoint happened?
Okay, there was a musician, he's still around, he's head of, I think he teaches arranging at NYU, his name is Rich Shamaria, and he was on the scene here, and he was writing for Disney during the day and working out there, and then moonlighting at night with his own jazz groups. And we would sneak in, you know, and check it out, and found out all about him. And I found myself in a show band with him playing commercial music, and that's how I met him. And he put some incredible, difficult charts in front of me, and no one had ever really asked me to read music at that point. And so I embraced that challenge, but then he was generous and reached out and said, you know, here, you're not doing this right, do this instead, and kind of pointed me in the right direction. That's been a theme of my entire career. So a couple years after that, I ran into him again, and we started playing together in a group, and he was very instrumental there, too, in helping me develop all of those jazz skills. That group was called Big Bamboo, and we had a house gig in place called Daisy's Basement. It was just what it sounded like. But a really cool little room that held about 100 people or so, and little grand piano, sound system, enough space for a decent-sized band. And they just got out of our way and let us do original music and things that no one else in Orlando was really doing. And it caught on, so we had a little bit of a scene. And then because all the theme parks were here, there's a steady stream of players who were like, I'm tired of traveling with these legacy big bands. I want to do something else, so I'm going to settle in Orlando and work at Disney. And then they would find their way to the nightclub scene at night. So we were sort of the non-Disney thing. And everybody would find, all the jazz musicians were there, and they needed something to, some way to get their musical rocks off. So they'd find their way to our stuff, and everybody was a great leader, and it was a sort of a fusion movement timing. If you think about Weather Report and Chick Corea, groups like that were who we were into at the time. The Cool Jazz Festival came through town. We were the go-to local group for anything like that. So we ended up opening for Miles 1 year, and Ray Charles another year, and James Brown another year. And it was just kind of a very active and thriving little jazz scene. There was a very popular local radio station here, WLOQ, that was kind of right at the beginning of the smooth jazz thing before that had started. And so it was a very diverse musical community. And I was growing up in the midst of that. For some reason, I was very smart in that I just hired musicians who were so much better than me. I was constantly surrounded by people who were challenging me to reach higher. And Larry Williams was exactly one of those people. Just a huge influence, somebody who set the bar so high that it was necessary for all of us to raise our own.
Beautiful. What was the first live jazz show you ever saw that really blew you away?
I think it was Rich Walker. Rich Walker is a guitarist. He's still alive. He's a few years older than me, maybe my sister's age, 6 years older. I'm 65. So Rich had a big, fat jazz guitar and played like Wes Montgomery. And there was this club that was just packed. And a friend of mine snuck me in. I was too young to get there, to go in. There's another local player that I snuck in to see, a guy named Joe Magic. He was a piano player and just burning, stride kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Bebop. And I was always really enamored of that. Joe played like Oscar Peterson. He was just really in the pocket. Of course, all these guys were, you know, degenerates and bad role models in many ways, but all just incredible musicians, and it was the beginning of a scene. And then eventually, I think when I moved on and out of Orlando, I think I realized that the work ethic that these people have instilled in me was dramatic. I had a hard time finding bands in other towns that wanted to work as hard as the guys in Orlando seemed to. We would rehearse a lot. Everybody wrote music. Everybody wanted to get their chart played. And the price for that was to be willing to come to a rehearsal. I think that's less and less common.
Well, you know, you've been at this for quite a while now. And what's been kind of the key to your longevity? What do you like the best about this process of being a professional musician?
I don't know how to do anything else. And so I think I started inventing ways to put a support system around it. My thing was, I just love playing guitar and singing and writing. And that's always been the thing since I was a little kid. So how do you keep doing that and get paid for it? And then initially that was easy. You could just play a commercial gig somewhere. Play whatever the popular music is and everybody will love you and you can make a living that way. But I just, because you write your own, if you write your own stuff, I think you want a little more than that. So I started trying to figure out how to create an infrastructure that would support that. And the record label was part of that. And then this, now this venue, and then sort of bringing it all together. I think the thing I love most about it, the whole process though, is there's a community around it. Because of the way I do it, it's not just a thing for me. It's a thing for the audience. It's a thing for the musicians. Everybody's getting a little pay. Everybody's getting an opportunity to do their own thing and play their own kind of music. And suddenly that becomes really important to them. There's a really great saxophone player. You probably play some of his stuff. His name is Jeff Rupert. He's a professor here at UCF. Well, Jeff plays here once a month and his own group. Marty Morell is in the band. It's a fantastic group. I called him up and I said, Jeff, this is a few years back, and I said, I really love your group. Every time you guys play, I'd like you to do a regular, steady, monthly gig. And so he took the gig, and then he called me about 3 days later and he said, I just want you to know I wrote 5 new tunes. There are 5 new tunes in the world. That's a thing that that's made my day. I created an opportunity for 5 new songs to be created, and they probably wouldn't have because he was busy. He was doing other things. But hey, I got a gig, and they're going to let me play my own music. I think I'm going to write some new music. And there's another guy over here named Dave McKenzie you'll probably hear more from him eventually, but amazing writer and arranger, and he fronts several of the bands that play here. And I heard him play one of his original tunes with me. I said, hey, how come we're not doing that? And so he put a really cool all-star band together called the Mind Meld Quintet. And they came in and they blew our minds. I mean, I had no idea the style of music he was going to present, but it's very modern and super hip. So, I mean, he's very successful with the older folks. You know, you can do a legit big band or takedown, you know, from the 1940s and lay it right on you. You know, completely authentic. So I wasn't expecting the modern fusion thing, but it's certainly amazing. And that finding that kind of talent and being able to have a vehicle for that, for them to share the vehicle with others, that's all part of it.
You know, it's interesting. I don't talk to a lot of musicians from Orlando, but it almost sounds a little bit like, you know, folks that go up into California near Disneyland. It almost seems like you have the steady income, but you also have the latitude to do what your dream is as a musician.
It used to be different. The Disney thing was an actual job. Eventually, the theme parks would kind of push the positions out of the park. So it's like now they hire musicians, but privately, one at a time or for a specific event, as opposed to having them on payroll year-round. Disney used to have a whole library department with music copyists in it, and they killed that a long time ago. So it's different now. But back then, there was a day job and a night scene, and it was a lot of fun. Because, you could go there and make a decent living, and then at night you could dabble in the dark arts, as it were.
Is there anybody out there in the world of music, jazz music more specifically, that you haven't seen live that you would love to catch live?
I'm sure there is. I mean, I'm drawing a blank at the moment. I don't think I've ever seen Chris Potter. I would really love to see Chris Potter. He's on the scene right now. I really want to see Pat Metheny's most recent group because, for a lot of reasons, I'm a big fan of Pat's, but his most recent addition on the keyboards is somebody who graduated from HSPVA, which is the High School for Performing Arts in Houston. And my friend Warren Sneed taught him. And then as he was doing his senior recital, the high school we're talking now, James assembled this band, and his family hired me to come and film it. So not knowing what was going to happen to him, I went and filmed his recital and gave it to his family. 6 months or so later, he's in New York. Hey, I'm playing with Pat Metheny now. So I was kind of,
wow.
I'm really excited to see him. That is, again, one of the cool things about having a venue is seeing moments like that. There's a guy who was here with Bob James, and he's a local kid. And he got the gig playing with Bob James. And they took him with him on the road. I was here when that happened. I remember that moment.
Yeah.
Veronica Swift played here before anybody knew who she was.
Yeah, she's great.
And it's just, you know, it's so cool to be there at that, you know, right then.
You know, everyone has a perception or an idea of who they think you are, your family, your friends, your fans. But you have a perception of you. You live your life. Who do you think you are?
I had an experience when I was in my 30s when my father passed away. And I think up to that point, my dad and I had been really on the outs, you know. And I moved, my sister and I hospiced him. And during that period of time, there was a lot of healing. And I guess we forgave each other, you know. And when it was all over, I was a different person. I was somebody who had done something unselfish. The first unselfish thing I'd ever done. And I got addicted to it. I felt so much better about who I was that I became a better person. And I started caring about other people and trying to bring other people into my, whatever I could do, was there a way to do it where I could also help someone else? So that was kind of the mindset we started with the record company. My wife had a corporate job. We were blessed with a little extra income, so we put it into jazz, knowing that it was the worst possible time to get into the jazz record business in the late 1900s. But it was But it was still a very fulfilling time, and all these people were benefiting from it. All these other people were benefiting from it. And I learned a lot of lessons from that. And so now, whatever the business model is, it includes this sense of community that lifts somebody else up right alongside you. And then what you end up finding out is that whatever it is you're trying to do has been informed by all of that. So if you're really looking for a selfish motivation, it's there. You're going to feel better. You're going to enjoy yourself more because you're going to have more fun because you're creating a situation where other people have more fun. I want you to think of me as that person. That's who I think of myself as. I want to be that person. I don't think I always live up to that goal, but that's what I want to try to do. I want to be somebody who moves the dial forward for everybody.
Man, that's a great answer. I love it. Yeah, that's beautiful. I think that's the thing about our life is forgiveness and redemption, and you know, if we're not here long enough to belabor over it. So that's a great answer. Chris, thanks for opening up. Right. Thanks for taking some time out.
Thank you, Joe.
I hope you heal up well. Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Appreciate you. Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New Orleans, Orlando, Kansas City, and spots all over the world giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Chris for his time, music, and cool. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.